strange new noises rise. Animal screeches, echoing hoots, beastly bellows, all completely alien to anything hiding in Matilda's memories. Bishop, Farrar, and Coyotl move silently through the ruin, weapons at the ready. Bishop kneels by the fire pit. He pokes at the mostly black coals, careful not to touch those that still shimmer with soft waves of orange. From the pit's edge, he pulls out a fist-sized chunk of half-burned wood. He tosses it to Coyotl, throws another to Farrar, then pulls out a third for himself. The boys set down their weapons. They rub the charcoal on arms, legs, faces. Farrar uses his shovel to cut free several long vines, which the boys wrap around themselves, coiling them over shoulders, across chests, around waists, tying them off here and there. Finally, the circle stars scoop up mud and grind it into their hair. Just like that, they are transformed. For a few hours, they were boys again, clean and beautiful. Now they are the jungle. Coyotl moves to the inside walls, checking them carefully, his thigh bone held in front of him. Farrar takes the outside. Bishop remains at the fire pit, fingers drumming an absent pattern on the head of his axe. I kneel next to him. Could they have heard us coming? No, we were very quiet. Even you and Spingate. He sounds surprised by that. I take it as a compliment. I am both afraid and excited. We couldn't have missed the Firemakers by much. They could be close. They might come back. Spingate joins us. She pokes at the ground next to the pit, pinches her fingers around something small and black. It's a bone. There's a little bit of flesh on here, she says. This animal was cooked. She waves her bracelet over the tiny bone. I wait for the jewels to give off the orange warning color, but they do not. Instead, they flash with a mixture of blues, greens, purples. Spingate smiles. Edible, she says. No sign of the red mold's toxin. That food in the warehouse, if all we need to do is cook it, we'll be fine. Did the fire burn it off? It doesn't work like that, she says. Fire kills the mold, but won't neutralize the toxin secreted by the mold. Damn it. Spingate turns the bone. Looks at it from a different angle. Maybe the mold can't grow on live animals, she says. Or maybe this particular animal is resistant to it. We need to catch one to find out. She doesn't have answers, but at least there's hope. We have to find the people who built this fire, befriend them if we can, learn their secrets. M, Bishop, Farrar calls out softly. Come see. We join him at the collapsed wall. He taps the tip of his shovel against the rubble. The broken edges are clean, he says. No moss or dirt on them. Something knocked this wall in, and very recently. In the fading light, a spot on the ground just past the collapsed wall catches my eye. A patch of blackness. I walk to it, careful not to trip on the loose rubble. The spot is a neat hole. From something long and pointed punching into the dirt. Long and pointed, like the feet of the creature that chased us out of the city. I think a spider knocked down this wall, I say. Maybe to get at the people who were inside. Is that why the fire was abandoned? Whoever the Firemakers are, I hope they got away. We are all suddenly aware that danger could be close by. Our eyes flick to every growing shadow. To every dark spot in this tangled mass of yellow, green, and brown. Those colors. The spider's shell matches them. Exactly. I glance at Bishop, Farrar, Coyotl. Their charcoal and vines and mud. Camouflage that lets them blend into the jungle. We have to get out of here, I say. Bishop nods, his mud-smeared face turning this way, then that, white eyes wide and darting. Back to the city wall, he says, and move quietly. Darkness falls. For only the second time in my short life, I see stars. We walk along the city wall, quiet as can be. We don't use the flashlights, for fear they might draw attention from the animals screaming in the night, or from the dreaded spider. Bishop leads us. Farrar and Coyote stay a few paces behind. I can't help but look up through the thick jungle canopy. Countless pinpricks of bright light, like sparkling jewels, impossibly distant and immensely beautiful. There are two big circles up there as well. One bluish, the other maroon. Spingate says the circles are moons, small planets that orbit Omeokan. That sounds impossible to me. But if Spingate says it, I believe her. City wall on our right, dark jungle ruins on our left. The spider could be anywhere. At night, it would be almost invisible in the trees, even if it was only a few steps away. But there was that whine. If it comes, hopefully we'll hear it before it sees us. If so, maybe we can hide. Spingate says the spider isn't alone, that there have to be enough of them to support a breeding population. Sometimes I wish she wasn't so smart. It might be better not to know some things. Bishop raises a fist. We stop instantly. He's staring down at his feet. No, at the wall near his feet. He waves us forward. He kneels, points to the base of the wall and looks up at me. Moonlight shines off his wide eyes. I look, but once again, I don't see anything. He reaches down and pulls the vines aside. There is a hole in the wall. I drop to my knees and look in. It's rough and uneven. The city walls are thick as two bishops lying head to toe. But past the far end, I see the moonlit base of a ziggurat. This hole goes all the way through. Someone spent a long time making this, chipping away bit by bit. It's narrow. I could crawl in easily, but I'm much smaller than the others. Ascent. Burned toast again. There 1 second, then gone. I look up at Bishop. Are you sure you can fit through? He shrugs. I know you can. I don't like the sound of that. Does he think I would leave without him? Even if we get inside, we're probably way past the edge of the map Gaston showed us, I say. We'll still be lost. Spingate kneels next to us. She taps the black jewel nestled in her ear. I can get us back with this, she says. It's out of range now, but if we get inside the wall and keep heading west, I think I'll be able to reach Gaston soon enough. Then he can guide us back. Bishop tilts his head toward the hole. Coyote, go through. Make sure it's safe. Coyote is muscular, yes, but his muscles are long and lean. Compared to Farrar and Bishop, he's skinny. He crawls into the hole, pushing his thigh bone and black bag before him. Bishop looks at me. You next, then Spingate, then Farrar. Then you? He looks at the hole. He shrugs again. He doesn't think he'll fit. Then we keep looking for another way in, I say. There has to be another gate farther up. Bishop shakes his head. We don't know that. Even if there is one, it could be closed, locked. You have to get back to the shuttle. Our people need you. The tunnel makes Coyote's voice sound strange. Nothing on this side. Come on through. Spingate crawls in, not waiting for permission. Bishop, you have to try, I say. We can't be separated, remember? Farrar, go, is his only response. Farrar throws his bag and shovel into the tunnel. He isn't quite as big as Bishop, but he's thicker than Coyote. He crawls in carefully, pushing the shovel before him. His grime-coated skin scrapes against the craggy surface, leaving little dirt smudges behind. If it's hard for Farrar, it's going to be very difficult for Bishop. Bishop points to the hole. Your turn, Em. And you'll follow me? His nostrils widen. He blinks rapidly. Yes, I'll follow you in. He's lying. This is the first time he's done that to me. He's terrible at it. You first, I say. Bishop looks out to the jungle, scanning for threats. Don't play games. Get back to the shuttle. Out in the solid darkness of trees, I hear something rustle. Something big. Bishop grabs my shoulder. Em, get into that tunnel now. I stand firm, You first. A loud crack. The whoosh of leaves and branches. I see a young tree fall. Moonlight playing off spinning leaves. Before it even hits the ground, a shadowy something scrambles over it. The spider. Coming fast. It will reach us in a minute, maybe less. Bishop shakes me so hard my head rattles. Get into the god's damned tunnel! He's hurting me again. He doesn't know his own strength, but I know mine. I slap him so hard my palm stings. Bishop stares at me, shocked. I am the leader, I say. I'm ordering you into that tunnel. He blinks, glances to the jungle. The spider is closing in, a moving shadow blur, scuttling over rubble and fallen walls, down the far side of craters and up the near, knocking over any thin trees in its way. Bishop throws his axe into the tunnel so hard, I bet it sails all the way through. He dives for the hole and gets stuck almost immediately, thick shoulders wedging against the rough surface. I look back at the rushing monster. It's too dark to see much, but Spingate was right. 5 spindly legs. A Matilda memory pops into my head. 5 legs, like a starfish. My body goes cold. Fear vanishes. If I'm going to die, that is the way of things. But with my last breath, I will make sure Bishop survives. I kneel. Bishop, slow down. Breathe. Put your right arm in first. Stretch as far as you can. He's still thrashing. His big frame holds so much power, but right now his size hurts him. I place a hand on the small of his back. At my touch, his body stills. Listen to me, I say. Right arm first. His left shoulder scoots back toward me as he reaches his right hand far in front. I feel his muscles flex, see his knees bend, his toes dig, his shoulders slide through. That's it. Keep your shoulders angled. Use your toes to push. He goes in farther. Now only his feet and ankles are visible. I look up, and that icy feeling explodes into hot fear. The spider is only 10 steps away, a crawling nightmare barely visible in the darkness, coming to rip me apart. Quickly but carefully, I slide my spear past Bishop, then dive in after him so fast I bang my head on the tunnel's edge. Brain ringing, I wriggle forward until my face presses against Bishop's filthy feet. He's blocking the way. My legs are still exposed. My chest is on the damp ground, and through it, I feel the vibrations of the spider's pounding feet. It should be on me already. Bishop! Move, move, move! Pain explodes through my calf. My body acts on its own, curling me into a ball, pulling my feet and legs away from the opening. I grab my spear. It's too long to turn around and use point first, so I jam the butt backward, feel it smash into something solid. Bishop crawls forward, slow but steady. My leg is on fire. What if the spider comes in after me? I turn slightly, just enough to look back down the tunnel. A patch of blackness blocks the opening. The creature is too big to fit inside. My leg screams. Is the spider's poison already spreading through me? A strange thought. Why didn't I hear that whine? I face forward and crawl. Someone pulls my spear out first, then strong hands grab my wrists and drag me free. The others pack in around me. Bishop's face is a mask of fear and concern. Are you hurt? I look at my leg. The moonlight plays off the glistening wetness coursing down my calf. It bit me, I say. Why are things always biting me? My calf seems to blur. The moonlight fades. Blackness drags me down. 10. My brain buzzes. Am I sliding into a dream or coming out of one? Strong arms carry me. My head rests against a warm chest. For once, I actually feel safe. My eyes open. Blackness and bright stars high above. Bishop is carrying me. She's awake! Spingate's voice. Em, can you stand?
I'm not sure. Let me try.
Bishop sets me down. The moment I put weight on my right foot, my calf sparks with agony. He bends to pick me up again.
No, I can make it on my own.
He looks doubtful, concerned, but he takes a step back. Farrar hands me my spear. I lean on it, take a few painful steps. Not the best solution, but it will do for now. Towering ziggurats rise up all around us. Shadow drapes everything, resistant to light from the double moons. Up ahead, there is a glow coming from behind a thick, curving wall of vines. We're back at the shuttle. My leg hurts. My calf is wrapped in a purple bandage that must have come from Spingate's medical kit. Spots of blood look black. Did the spider poison me? Spingate shakes her head. It doesn't look like a bite or a puncture wound. I think you tore it on a sharp rock. I not only banged my head against the tunnel entrance, I hurt my leg on it as well. I thought the spider was right on top of me. In my desperation to escape, I must have flailed about too much, caught my calf on a jagged edge. The fear of that moment comes rushing back. My body starts to shiver. Spingate holds me tight. You made it through, she says, gently stroking my hair. That's all that matters. She lets me go, rubs my back as she guides me down the street. We're almost there. Smith is waiting to look at you and Bishop both. Bishop has purple bandages wrapped around one shoulder. The other shoulder is tied with strips of blood-streaked white cloth. I realize that most of Spingate's shirt is gone, shredded into strips. The fabric that remains barely covers her breasts. We ran out of bandages, she says. Bishop insisted I use what I had on you first. I improvise for his wounds. We climb up the wall of vines. Coyote stays close to me, helping me when I stumble. I feel weak, weak and dizzy. At the top, I pause, look out at our shuttle. Lights on the tail, the wingtips, the top, all gleaming and welcome. We made it. Coyote helps me descend the ring of vines. I'm almost to the bottom when I freeze, that now all too familiar blast of paralyzing fear driving straight through me. Two grown-ups sprinting toward us. It's all right, Coyote says. That's Visca and Baudin. As soon as he says that, I see it. Visca and Baudin, yes, but dressed all in black. The coveralls in the storeroom. My pulse is racing. I can barely see straight. I need to lie down. The two circle stars sprint to the top of the vine ring, scouting for danger in case we were followed here. The rest of us shuffle to the shuttle. Farrar, Spingate, and Coyote start up the ramp. Bishop stops at the base. So do I. Spingate turns. She's beyond exhausted. Em, come on. You need to see Smith. In a minute, I say. Just go. She doesn't need to be told twice. She drags herself through the door. Baudin and Visca return. I send them into the shuttle, leaving Bishop and me alone once again. He can barely meet my eyes. He's ashamed. At the hole in the wall, he panicked and he knows it. He wanted to protect me, but I sent him into the tunnel first, exposing myself to danger so he could get away. He tilts his head toward the shuttle door. He wants me to go inside. He needs to be the last one out here. Bishop, we should talk about what happened at the waterfall. What happened is we were stupid, he says. We were selfish, only worrying about ourselves. People could have been hurt. As if I didn't feel guilty enough about that already. In at least one way, Bishop and I are the same. We have a need, an urge to protect everyone. I don't understand why sometimes I can't think straight when I'm around him. Or O'Malley, for that matter. What I do know is that my selfish actions almost got our friends killed. I glance up at the shuttle, out to the vine ring. No one else is here. I reach out and take his hand. We just have to be smarter, I say. I think about him kissing me. I want him to do it again. We won't do anything like that around other people. He stares at our hands for a moment, fingers intertwined. He gives me one short, firm squeeze, then pulls away. "We won't do anything like that, period," he says. "We're fighting to keep everyone alive, Em. I can't lose sight of that, not even for a second." When we kissed, there was this look in his eyes. He couldn't get enough of me. That look is gone. I feel like everything is ruined. I trudge up the ramp. This is what happens when you let your emotions control you. Well, never again. At the shuttle door, O'Malley is waiting for me. He's wearing black coveralls. A scabbard hangs from his waist, the jeweled handle of his knife sticking out. And he has boots. My leg hurts so much I'd almost forgotten about my poor feet, beat up from the long hike, punctured by dozens of thorns. A Mictlan patch, just like the symbol on our ties, is stitched in metallic thread on O'Malley's left breast. He's holding a black blanket. When I stumble in, he wraps it around me. "Welcome home, Em." He's clean. His hair is combed, glossy black and perfect. It surprises me how good it feels to see his face. I glance back down the ramp at Bishop, notice the contrast between the two boys. One scrubbed and neatly dressed, as if our living nightmare never happened. The other shirtless, bloody, and bandaged, a walking testament to what we just endured. O'Malley's smile fades. "Bad news. Aramovsky got into deck 4. His arm around my shoulders, he guides me into the coffin room. I see the familiar faces of Gaston, Beckett, Smith, Visca, and the others. I see Zubiri, Walizak, and the kids we found wandering the halls of the Zolotl. I also see faces I don't recognize. Hundreds of them. No, not hundreds. I already know the exact number. 168. Aramovsky. God damn him. He opened the coffins. Little faces on little bodies. Kids dressed in clean, perfectly fitting white shirts, red ties, and black pants or red and black plaid skirts. More mouths to feed. Everything catches up with me in a crashing wave of despair that washes away the last of my strength. The room spins. I'm tired. So tired. O'Malley, get me out of here. Take me to Smith. I don't care what she does to me, as long as she gives me more of that gas and puts me under. 11. My eyes flutter open. I'm lying on firm padding. I see something white, close above my face, too close. I'm in a coffin again. I am trapped. Someone put me in here. Matilda put me in here. She won't take me. She won't. I'll fight and have to get out. Have to get... No. It's not like that. I think I remember people putting me in here. O'Malley. Yes, that was it. And Smith. I'm not trapped. But this tiny space is squeezing in on me. Can I get out?
Yes. Hold on.
Someone is nearby. Such a relief. I close my eyes and take deep breaths, try to control myself. So confined in here. So tight. The white above my face splits down the middle, slides away to the sides. Spingate grins down at me. She's dressed in black, just like O'Malley. "Hello there, Sleeping Beauty." Someone else leans in next to her, smiling at me. It's Smith, the skinny circle cross girl with the short brown hair who was in Bishop's group back on the Zolotl. She's also wearing the black coveralls. Her gray eyes are so pretty. "Your leg was badly wounded," she says. "Spingate did a good job binding it, but there was only so much she could do in the field. You lost enough blood to make you dizzy. Or maybe you were just exhausted and stressed." "Leaders don't get stressed," I say. Smith sighs. "As you like. How do you feel now? Better?" "I do." I take a deep breath. I don't just feel better. I feel great. They help me sit up. Cloth against my skin. I'm wearing black coveralls. I stretch my arm out, look myself up and down. The coveralls have long sleeves and many pockets. New black socks on my feet. Except for my face and hands, I'm completely covered. For the first time in my few days of life, I'm wearing clothes that fit. My hands are clean. I touch my face, also clean. And the big bump on my head? It's almost gone. I tenderly try out my split lip. Healed. Smith and Spingate steady me as I step onto the floor. The room marked medical is small and white. There is a second coffin, open and empty. Both coffins are dark brown, glossy, and clean. They are free of intricate carvings. But other than that, they look just like the one I fought my way out of on the Zolotl. Off to the right, a single white pedestal with a red circle cross engraved on the stem. Smith taps the coffin's edge. Put your foot up here. She sounds as confident as Gaston does in the pilot house. I do as I'm told. She slides my pant leg up to my knee, touches my calf. She leans in, checks the area that was wounded. She squeezes the muscle and I wince. Smith's smile is full of pride. All better, Em. See for yourself. My calf is slightly bruised. There's a thin, pink line that shows me where the tear was, but it looks like the wound happened years ago. That's amazing, I say. How did you know what to do? Gaston said you wanted me to come in here and learn all I could. As soon as I started, some of those blank areas in my head filled in. I remembered medical classes, people teaching me things, and how to use the medical system. The machines perform most of the work. I just use the pedestal to ask questions and make a decision as to what needs to be done. Another person with recovered memories. Some, anyway. And these particular memories are critical to our survival. It feels good knowing that Smith is ready to take care of us. She opens a cabinet, hands me a pair of black boots. It's all I can do not to squeal with delight. As I put them on and start tying them, I look up at Spingate. Was I asleep long? All night and half the day. That's a long time. Too long. Has the spider shown up? Spin shakes her head. Not yet, anyway. O'Malley made everyone stay inside the shuttle. He said that if it can stop attacks from the grown-ups, it can probably stop the spiders. I finish tying my boots. I stand, put my weight on my leg, bounce on it. My calf is sore, but it feels so much better. Smith, you're amazing. She blushes. She can be as modest as she likes, as long as she keeps fixing us up. Hey, where are my old clothes? Spingate's face wrinkles. Incinerated, I hope. Em, we stank. O'Malley brought me down here. My face flushes hot as I think of him seeing me naked. Who undressed me? Don't worry. The med chamber did it, Smith says, gesturing to the gleaming coffin. It removed your old clothes, cleaned you up, treated your wounds, fed you intravenously, handled your waist, and fixed your hair. It even put on your new clothes for you. She calls it a med chamber? I like that, although I suspect she'll be the only person to use that term. This thing handled my waist. Disgusting. But it explains a lot. I was in my original coffin for years, centuries, according to Brewer. The coffin took care of me. Some of the Zolotl's coffins broke down. The kids inside of those died. If things break down here, what will happen? Smith can use this equipment, but can she fix it if it stops working? Same thing with Gaston and flying the shuttle, or Spingate and the bracer. Knowing how to use technology is not the same as knowing how to make it, or how to repair it. Spingate puts a hand on my shoulder. Time to go up. Everyone is waiting for you on deck one. Why? The meeting, she says. O'Malley said when he brought you down here, you told him as soon as you woke up you wanted a meeting about the food situation. Other than O'Malley putting that blanket around me and showing me the new kids, I barely remember talking to him. I must have really been out of it. Still, a meeting is exactly what we need. So many people to feed now, I say. Aramovsky's stupid act might mean we starve. God damn him. Smith's eyes narrow. Because you're in charge, you think you can curse like that? Because you're in charge. So close to what Coyote said at the waterfall. Do people think I'm abusing my position as leader? Well, someone has to make decisions, and I have every right to be angry at Aramovsky. He shouldn't have woken them, I say. They were in those coffins for centuries. A few more days wouldn't have hurt. How did he wake them up anyway? Did his progenitor know how to operate the coffins? Spingate looks down, takes a small step away from Smith. Smith glares at me defiantly. You, I say to her. You open the coffins. She crosses her arms. Aramovsky asked for my help. He said the gods willed it. The pedestal had instructions for waking them, just like it had instructions for healing you. I remember Spingate's words in the pilot house, her worry that the kids might already be overwritten. Spin, are they like us? She nods quickly, instantly understanding my concern. O'Malley and Gaston said the new kids didn't know who they were or where they were, just like when we woke up. The kids were terrified. There is anger in her voice. Like me, she understands how much trouble we're in, now that our numbers have doubled but our food has not. I wish I had my spear. I'm so mad, I could almost use it on Smith. I'm hot in the face and chest. It feels the same as when I lost my temper with Spingate. The difference is, Smith did do something to deserve it. You woke them up, Smith, I say. Can you put them back to sleep? She juts out her chin. You don't have the right to do that. You answer my question. Something in my voice makes her take a step back. It's not safe for them, she says. Once someone comes out of a coffin for the first time, they're alive. Putting them back into deep sleep could kill them. Her words, or Aramovsky's. You're lying, I say. I have no idea if she is, or if she's telling the truth. I'm just so frustrated. Smith sneers. You think you know everything. Well, you don't know anything about this. If you're smart, you'll believe me. I want to hit something. We've worked so hard, sacrificed so much, and now everything is at risk. My fury isn't going to fix anything, though. Not when our survival is at stake. Calm plans can keep us alive. Decisions driven by anger could move us closer to death. A knock on the room's metal door. Smith walks to it. The handprint there, of course, has a circle cross in the palm. She presses it, and the door slides open. O'Malley, holding my spear. He enters, smiling that lovely smile of his. He hands me the spear. Em, you look much better. He glances at Smith and Spingate. Can Em and I have a quick moment alone? Sure. Spingate says. I have to test some of the shuttle's food stores before the meeting anyway. Make sure the mold hasn't gotten in. Smith, come help me. Smith looks like she would rather go anywhere than with Spingate, but follows her out. O'Malley waits a moment to make sure they're too far away to overhear. Everyone knows about the spider, the food warehouse, and the mold, he says. They are afraid. They need to hear from their leader that we'll find a solution. I'm sure people are scared. I'll do what I can to make them feel better. Thank you, I say. But I don't remember asking for a meeting. Did I? He shrugs. I figured you would want to talk when you woke up, so I told everyone you called a meeting. That seems like odd behavior. Why didn't you just say it was your idea? Because people listen to you. You're the leader. Ready? I'm not happy he lied. I'm also not happy that I left him in charge and came back to chaos. We'll go in a minute, I say. First, what happened while I was gone? How could you let Aramovsky open up the coffins? The question angers him. I didn't let him do anything. Gaston never left the pilot house. I had to control the kids from the Zolotl. They were getting into the food, going outside, running around. While I was busy watching them, Aramovsky slipped away. I notice the cut on O'Malley's cheek is almost gone. It's just a pink line, barely even a scar. Smith healed him, too. I point to the coffins. Did Aramovsky and Smith let the new kids out while you were in one of those? He reactively touches his cheek. I've caught him in a second lie. Yes, he says. I didn't think Aramovsky would try something while I was in there. How could I have known he would? It makes sense now. With me, Spingate and Bishop gone, with O'Malley unconscious, with Gaston learning about the shuttle, no one was watching Aramovsky. Someone always needs to be watching him. Em, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. He did. I'm so angry at O'Malley. He always seems to think things through, but this time he didn't. Sorry won't keep us alive. The next time I tell you to do something, do it. Do you understand what this does to us? That familiar blank expression settles over him. I get it, he says. His voice is thin, his words clipped. Are you finished yelling at me? I can only hope I've made my point. I'm finished. Let's go. 12. Deck One's coffin room is packed. People sit or stand on closed coffins, sit on the black floor in the aisles, lean against the red walls. Almost 300 faces, most of which I've never seen before, stare back at me. White-shirted little kids whisper to each other, pointing at me as if I'm an ancient myth come to life. Everyone my age is dressed in coveralls and boots. O'Carrickey and Johnson, Borjigin and Beckett, Bawden and Farrar. Even Bishop, who stands by the shuttle door, red axe at his side. They all wear black. I can't help but think of the grown-ups we left back on the Zolotl. Gaston is standing on a small stage, made from empty food bins. He sees me and steps down. As I walk toward it, people close in behind me. I'm surrounded. I step up on the stage. For once, I am taller than most of the people here. I look out at the massive faces. They're waiting for me to tell them what happens next, that everything will be fine. I see everyone except Spingate. Where is she? I'd feel better if she was here. Thank you all for coming. First thing out of my mouth, and it's so stupid. Where else would they be? Silence makes me nervous, so I fill it. Hello to you new kids. I know this is scary, but I was just like you not long ago. Frightened, confused, no idea of what was happening. Try to relax. You're with us now. See the people in black? They've been through far worse than this. We... A little hand goes up. Zubiri's. Yes? Food, she says. She puts her arm down, stands. No smile this time. She's as serious as Bishop. What are we going to do about food? That's something we'd all like to know. We're working on it. There are animals here we can eat. It's just a matter of figuring out how to catch them. And we haven't even started looking at plants yet. It might be... Aramovsky raises his hand. I know he's going to try and cause trouble, but I just answered Zubiri's question. I can't have people think I'm ignoring only him. Yes, Aramovsky? Who built the fire? Other than having us cower in the shuttle, what have you done to protect us from this threat? He's doing it again. Asking me questions to which he knows there are no answers. He's trying to make me look bad. We don't know if they're a threat. You didn't find any food, he says, not hiding his disgust. Now the fire builders, whoever they are, probably know we're here. Sounds like your trip was a failure. We found water, I say. Without fresh water, we'll all die. Does that sound like a failure? Water we can't get to is the same as no water at all. How are you going to kill the spiders that guard it, Em? Why does he have to be so difficult? I hate him. We don't know yet, I say. We will find a way. Now, about our food situation. Gaston, assuming we eat small animals, how long will the shuttle supplies last? Gaston glances across the room at Borjigin, the half-circle wisp of a boy with big teeth and straight hair, as black as his coveralls. When I left for the warehouse, he and Opkick were doing inventory on the storerooms.
12 days, Borjigin says. If we stretch it.
I feel some of the pressure ease out of the room. A bubble of calm sets in. We're in bad shape, but we're not going to die tomorrow. Then, that bubble bursts.
It's worse than that.
Spingate. She's standing in the back wall's open door. She must have been on deck too. Maybe in one of the labs. She holds up a white package. Crackers.
This came from a bin we opened when we landed. Not even 2 days ago.
She waves her bracer above the package. The jewels flash orange.
Contaminated, she says. Enough to make us sick. Maybe even enough to kill us. Everything in the open bins is contaminated. We have to assume the only safe food is in bins that are still sealed. Even those might go bad.
I look at Gaston. How many bins did we already open? He hesitates before answering.
About half of them.
We have at most 7 days worth of food left. Not enough time to farm. Maybe enough to learn to trap those small animals. But how many of those would we need? Every single day? To feed 300 people? Gaston looks nervous, like he thinks the crowd is about to attack him.
Not my fault, he says. We didn't know about the mold.
Beckett stands up. The tan-skinned redhead had said almost nothing since my group merged with Bishop's, but he's suddenly so mad he can't help himself.
Why did you open so many bins, Gaston?
Beckett points to the gear symbol on his own forehead.
A real scientist would have tested first, made sure there was no reaction from the environment.
Gaston huffs.
You're a real scientist! I wouldn't have ruined half our food.
Grumbles of agreement, even a few shouts. Gaston couldn't have known, yet people blame him anyway. This room is growing angry fast. Bauden points at some of the new kids.
The food would last longer if it wasn't for all those new empties.
The coffin room falls quiet. That word again. O'Malley was embarrassed he said it. Bauden is not. I don't know the names of all the Zolotl kids, but I recognize their faces. On their foreheads, symbols. Circles, yes. But also circle stars, half circles, gears, circle crosses, and a double ring. On the foreheads of the new faces, though, I see only one symbol. The empty circle. Like mine. I scan the crowd. Find O'Malley. I know full well he already counted.
Are all of the new kids circles?
He nods. What does that mean? An entire shuttle full of my people? No, everyone here is my people. In only one other place were all the symbol circles. The countless massacred bodies in Bishop's section of the Zolotl. I see some people my age glaring at the new kids. The children sense this sudden hostility. They lean into each other, hold each other, eyes flicking from one black-clad person to the next. Can we really be capable of turning on each other this fast? We're not even hungry yet. What will happen when we are?
Bauden, that word is off limits, I say. Don't use it again.
She sneers.
It doesn't mean anything. Their circles are empty, and you can't tell me what to do.
A metal-on-metal gong reverberates through the room, makes everyone jump. All heads turn toward Bishop. He has smashed the flat of his red axe against the red wall. He stares straight at Bauden.
M is our leader, Bishop says. His voice is calm but unforgiving.
That means she can tell you what to do. She got us this far, didn't she?
Bauden stares at Bishop as if she's ready to fight him. But he isn't being aggressive. He's asking her to cooperate, not ordering her. That seems to make a difference. She looks at me.
Fine. I won't use that word anymore.
Not an apology, but it's something. How can we know a word is bad, but not know why it's bad? Aramovsky stands on a closed coffin.
We shouldn't fight each other, he says. The mold is our biggest threat. And its red color is no coincidence. It is punishment from the God of Blood, because not enough of us have accepted his divine way.
Spingate shakes her head.
It isn't a punishment, you idiot. It's biological.
I see, Aramovsky says.
Well, since it's biology, I'm sure you already have a cure.
He smiles.
You'll cure this before we run out of food, right, Spingate?
Her face wrinkles with rage. She rightfully blames him for waking these kids up in the first place.
Science doesn't work that way, she says. It's a process.
Aramovsky looks around the room, playing to the crowd.
She can't promise us when she'll find a cure. Or if there even is a cure. See what happens if you put science over faith?
The package of crackers smacks into his head, making him wince in surprise. She puts her hands on her hips.
When you put science over faith, you save lives, she says. Those crackers that just bounced off your thick skull, if you had eaten those, you'd be dead. My science revealed that before anyone got hurt. Why didn't your god tell Farrar not to eat the contaminated food? Does your god want everyone to die?
Aramovsky's eyes narrow. Not everyone, Spingate. He stretches out his long arm and points a finger at her.
Just those who deserve it.
Around the room, roars of outrage, and some of approval. I slam the butt of the spear down on the makeshift stage. The plastic thonk isn't as impressive as Bishop cracking his axe against the wall, but it quiets the room. Spear in hand, I step off the stage and stride toward Aramovsky. People scramble out of my way. I stand in front of him, not hiding my anger.
Did you just threaten Spingate's life?
Of course not, he says. I was merely answering her question.
You pointed at her when you said it.
He speaks loudly, making sure everyone can hear him.
My apologies. I see how that might have looked.
He faces Spingate, bows.
I would never threaten your life. Only the God of Blood can decide who lives and who dies.
He stands straight again, looks down at me.
Just like only the gods can decide who leads.
My skin prickles. Is he challenging my leadership? That thickness in my chest again, my temper surging. I control it, but barely. I lean close to him, whisper so quietly he has to bend forward to hear. If anything happens to Spingate, I'll hold you responsible. Aramovsky glances at my spear. The blade is only inches from his face. He wants it, wants to stab me with it. Bishop clears his throat.
Aramovsky, let's take a walk.
The tall boy's face goes blank. He looks around the room as if searching for someone who will help him. Everywhere he looks, people stare at the ground. No one wants to cross Bishop. First Baudin, now Aramovsky. Bishop is making things worse. People will think I can't handle problems on my own. I want to tell Bishop to be quiet, but if I say something now, it will just cause more confusion.
Now, Aramovsky, Bishop says.
A word, please. Aramovsky swallows, smooths out his new black coveralls. He walks to the door, trying to look like this doesn't bother him. He and Bishop exit the shuttle. The coffin room is quiet, tense. No one knows what to say. How did things get out of control so fast? The only noise comes from Spingate. She's crying a little. Because she's so angry, I think. Gaston stands next to her, rubbing her back. Some people are looking at her like she did something wrong. O'Malley steps onto the stage.
That's all for now, everyone, he says. As soon as we have more information, we'll share it.
He steps down, walks to me, whispers, can I see you in the pilot house? O'Malley is better at these situations than I am. Maybe he can help me figure out what to do next. I follow him to the pilot house. He closes the door behind us. 13. The pilot house walls are solid black. Perhaps this place only comes to life for Spingate or Gaston. It hits me that if anything happens to them, we won't be able to take the shuttle anywhere. Beckett is a gear. Could he fly it? O'Malley leans against a wall, Aramovsky is a problem.
Wow, Chancellor, you're really observant.
He says nothing. His expression remains blank. I take a slow breath. I'm so mad at Aramovsky, I want to attack everything and everyone. Sorry, I say.
I can't believe he threatened Spingate.
While you were gone, he was talking to people. He wants everyone to follow his religion. I feel my teeth grinding.
He doesn't even know what the religion is. The God of Blood? Doesn't sound familiar to me at all.
I think he's making it up as he goes along.
He doesn't care about truth, Em. He cares about power. Your power. I don't have any power.
O'Malley shakes his head.
You do. That's why you're the only leader for us. That's why you're the only leader for me.
Watch him, I say.
Really watch him this time. We can't let him do something else to make things even worse.
O'Malley comes closer. There is a hunger in his eyes. I see his gaze flicking over my face, like he's trying to take in every part of me all at once. He reaches out, gently holds my shoulders. Even through the coveralls, his touch sends a tingle through my body. He smiles, which chases away my thoughts of anything but that smile. My breath gets short. What is he doing? I try to tell him to stop, but the words won't come out. He pulls me closer.
Em, you're so beautiful.
He said the same thing on deck 3 when he was looking at Matilda's face. Because my bruises have healed, right? Now I'm pretty enough for you. Is that it, O'Malley?
When we're alone, you can call me Kevin.
He leans closer.
You were the first thing I saw when I woke up. You'll always be pretty to me.
I want to be mad, but I can't. So I'm healed up now, so what? This isn't Matilda's face. It's mine. O'Malley is so sure, so confident. But I'm confused. Bishop likes me. I know he does. He kissed me. Now, though, it's like he doesn't want to be near me. O'Malley leans in. He's moving slowly, giving me plenty of chances to pull away if I want to. I don't. His lips meet mine. It feels delicious. As good as it felt with Bishop, but different. Does every boy kiss different? O'Malley's fingertips caress the back of my neck. I can't think of anything but him, his lips, the way he smells, the feel of his hands on my body. Unlike Bishop, O'Malley wants me, and he's not shy about it.
Bishop.
Our kiss almost got Spingate killed. I shove O'Malley. He stumbles back, surprised.
Don't ever kiss me again.
I try to sound hard, but my words come out as a cracked plea. He smiles.
I won't. Until you ask me to.
Anger floods in, washing away the confused feelings.
That's not going to happen, I say. Now get out.
His smile widens. So stunning, and yet there is something off about it.
As you wish, Empress.
He leaves the pilot house. I close my eyes, try to calm myself. I didn't want him to stop, I admit it. But who does he think he is?
I don't know.
But I know what he doesn't think he is. He doesn't think he's a leader. He's not like Aramovsky in that way, or even Bishop. O'Malley is comfortable being at my side, giving me counsel, providing the information I need. Not once has he challenged my leadership. Not once has he stepped in because he thought I couldn't handle something. But just now he was so aggressive. Not physically. He was emotionally aggressive. When I opened his coffin and looked at his face for the first time, I had never seen anything so beautiful. Since then, I've experienced so much more. Spaceships, cities, ruins, stars and moons, blood and death, love and tenderness. And through all of that, Kevin O'Malley is still the most beautiful thing I have ever known. He kissed me. He wants me. I don't know if I can be mad at him. I don't know if I can be mad at Bishop either. I don't know what to think about any of this. A shake of my head, a rub of my face. Push those thoughts away, Em. There are more important things to worry about. We need food. There are people who survive in Omeokan's jungle, who obviously know what to eat. For us to survive, I have to find them. And that means tomorrow, as soon as it's light, we have to go outside the walls again.
14. The sun is about to rise. Most everyone is still asleep. I am in the pilot house with my friends, Spingate, Gaston, O'Malley, and Bishop, and unfortunately, Aramovsky. I don't want him here, but what choice do I have? If he's with me, he's not talking behind my back, and as much as I hate to admit it, he's smart. I won't ignore good ideas just because they come from someone I don't like. We stand around Gaston's map. Somehow, the area shown seems smaller than before. We all know how much trouble we're in, I say, concentrating on not looking at Aramovsky when I do. You are the people I trust to help me make decisions. I think we need to send a party to the fire pit. But a spider was in the jungle, O'Malley says. I nod. It was also inside the city walls. If it's a threat no matter where we go, we might as well try to find the people who know what food is safe to eat. Spingate hugs her shoulders. Everyone else looks rested. She looks like she hasn't slept at all. It's not just the spider, she says. We heard many animals, and the people who made that fire might be hostile. We're desperate. If they are hostile, we can take the food from them. How far are we willing to go to survive? We should focus on the mold, Spingate says. The labs on Deck 2 have scientific equipment and pedestals with instructions on how to use it. I'm studying the mold, trying to find a way to neutralize the toxin. I worked on it all night. No wonder she's so tired. Brewer knew about the mold, I say. Is there any information about it in the pedestal's memory? She shakes her head. How convenient, Aramovsky says. I shoot him a glare, but he ignores it, continues. You and your cure, Spingate. How long will it take? She shrugs. Maybe 10 days, maybe 20, maybe never. Keep working on it, I say. You can do that while the rest of us look for other solutions. Gaston gestures to the countless buildings laid out on the map. We've only looked in the warehouse, right? Other buildings could have uncontaminated food. We need to search them. And as far as we know, there are people in this city. We just haven't seen them yet. He drags his fingertip through the map, leaving a glowing line from the dot that represents the shuttle, through the streets we use to reach the warehouse, then to the waterfall. I see his point. We've explored only a tiny portion of this city. The warehouse bins were sealed, O'Malley says. The mold got in anyway. If we find more food, odds are it will be in the same condition. Still worth a try, Gaston says. We should explore. Maybe that's dangerous, too. But there are a lot of us. And Gaston is right. We have to try everything. We'll send teams to search buildings around the landing pad, I say. We'll assign lookouts. Keep the teams close enough that they can run to the shuttle if the spider is spotted. We can do that in addition to sending a team to the fire pit. O'Malley crosses his arms, purses his lips in thought. There are thousands of buildings. If only there was a way to see if some were more important than others. Gaston, the landing pad had to have power to rise up, right? Gaston nods. I think it has its own small power plant. Nuclear, probably? When the shuttle came in range, I think the power plant activated. O'Malley opens his mouth to speak, but Gaston cuts him off. Before you throw out your genius idea, O'Malley, I already asked the shuttle if it could detect other buildings with power. It said that capability had been erased, like almost everything else I've asked it. O'Malley puts his hands on his knees, bends, so he's looking down the north-south street at eye level. Maybe the shuttle has bad memories like us. Maybe it's recovering them, just like we are. Ask it again. Gaston rolls his eyes. All right, fine, O'Malley. Let's do it one more time, just for you.
Shuttle?
Yes, Captain Xander?
Highlight any buildings or areas that have power.
A small circle lights up below the shuttle icon, and so does one other spot, the massive ziggurat at the city center.
But, wow, it worked, Gaston says.
O'Malley, I take back half the bad things I've ever said about you.
This seems strange to me. It was almost like O'Malley already knew what the shuttle would find. Did he remember an access code for the pedestals on Deck 3? No, that can't be. He would have told me right away if he had.
Let's test our luck, Gaston says. Then, in an overly sweet voice,
Shuttle, love of my life, my true north, do you know what that building is?
Yes, Captain Xander. That is the observatory.
Bishop's face wrinkles.
What's an observatory?
A place to see stars, Gaston says.
Bishop points up.
We can see them at night. We don't need a building for that.
It still has power, Spingate says, ignoring him. We have to go there. If the city builders wanted to make sure their knowledge was preserved, science, engineering, maybe even history, they would store that knowledge in a database of some kind. It makes sense they'd keep that database in a building that maintained power no matter what happened.
History, Aramovsky says, his voice full of longing. We might finally learn what our symbols mean.
O'Malley's eyes flick to me, then instantly back to the map. He looks guilty, almost as if he already knows what the symbols mean and isn't telling us. Spingate leans over the map, squints at the towering ziggurat. The city builders must have encountered the red mold. Maybe they found a way to beat it.
Bishop grunts. If they beat it, why would people leave?
Spingate throws up her hands.
I don't know. Why do you people think I already know everything?
Look, if the observatory holds any data on the red mold, I have to have it.
She stops. She's breathing hard. A heavy lock of curly red hair hangs in front of her face. Bishop's point disturbs me. Is the red mold the reason the city is empty? Did it drive people out? Did it kill them all? If so, what chance do we have of surviving here? I stare at the ziggurat's image. At this scale, where most buildings are the size of my thumb, that one is as big as my head. It's so real I could almost reach out and brush the vines away from the stone.
O'Malley clears his throat. The observatory isn't far from here, he says. Someone could leave now. Be there about midday and take a look. They'd be back just after sunset. I know we're short on time and food, but one day isn't much to sacrifice if it saves us the risk of sending people into the jungle. Also, Em, you were saying earlier that we need to know if there are any spiders close to the shuttle. Whoever goes to the observatory could also reconnoiter our area.
Bishop's head snaps up at the word reconnoiter. He nods in wholehearted agreement. He uses his fingertip to trace a glowing path down the streets, moving from the shuttle to the towering ziggurat. He traces another path back, using different streets.
I could take two circle stars with me, he says. We'd be able to check a large area of the extended perimeter for spiders and recon the big ziggurat. Great idea, Em.
It is a great idea. But did I come up with it?
Maybe.
There's so much going on, I can't remember everything I've said. Or did O'Malley once again pretend his idea was mine? Either way, it's a good plan, but not one without risks.
It might be too dangerous, I say.
That's a long time to be gone with the spider out there somewhere. Bishop stands tall and rigid, holds his axe against his chest. He seems to be staring at something that isn't there.
We are shadows.
His voice sounds different, quiet and soft.
We are the wind. We are death.
The rest of us glance at each other, not knowing what to say. Bishop's blank stare is creepy. What just happened to him? I gently put a hand on his arm. Bishop, what does that mean?
His trance breaks. His face flushes red. It means Circle stars can move quietly, that's all. I think some of my memories came back. I was taught to say that phrase when I was little. We were instructed on how to move without a sound, how to track people and animals, how to sneak up on anyone, how to... His voice trails off, but I know what he was going to say. How to kill. Like how I was taught math and science, Spingate says. They trained me early. I mean, they trained my progenitor.
Like I was taught how to pray, Aramovsky says. Or fly, Gaston says.
Flying, fighting, science, even religion,